we had a terrorist attack in Moscow. The U.S. officials are talking about ISIS-K. What's your take on this terrorist attack?
Well, we have heard from the Russian officials. We've heard from the Russian officials that a very serious investigation is underway. We've heard from the Russian officials that the attackers appeared to be extremists in nature. We've also heard from the Russian officials that they have incontrovertible evidence that people inside Ukraine were preparing to receive the attackers as heroes, and that they'd like to know more about that. We've also heard from the Russian officials that they have been monitoring the phone calls of these people. They have the phones, they have the phone records. And we've learned that because of these records, they were able to arrest 11 people in Moscow who were providing assistance and work with the Turkish authorities to arrest 40 more people in Turkey. So I think the Russians are the only ones who are speaking with anything closely resembling fact. We have heard from the Americans. They have released a warning from the U.S. Embassy in Moscow on October 7th or March 7th that said there was danger of an immediate attack against places where the public congregates, including concert halls. It's amazing enough, very specific detail. And we also know that one of the attackers scouted out the concert hall in question on the same day that the U.S. Embassy press release was put out because they planned on attacking this concert hall on March 9th. That falls within the 48-hour window, by the way, of the U.S. Embassy press release. What was happening on March 9th? Oh, yeah, the Russian superstar Shaman was going to give a or did give a concert, sold-out concert, but the security was too heavy. So they backed off and they ended up attacking on March 22nd. I know when Maria Zakharova speaks, oftentimes she's doing it. I mean, it's always effective, but she's doing it for impact, meaning to show how foolish people are. But I'll focus less on the fact that she says the United States hasn't solved who killed President Kennedy yet. And more on the fact that the United States, has been very mum about the Nord Stream 2 attacks and who did that. And yet instantly the United States was able to say that it was ISIS-K and it wasn't Ukraine. I'd like to know more about why the United States makes that claim. I'd be interested in that. And I think everybody should be asking that question before they embrace the narrative put out by the United States. Ask the question why they've put that narrative out in the time frame that they have. I'm far more comfortable in embracing the Russian narrative because, unlike anybody else, the Russians are the only ones who are putting facts on the table.
Do you find any type of similarity between these people and the terrorist attacks that we've seen so far from ISIS?
You know, ISIS is, first of all, to think of ISIS as a singularity, even ISIS-K as a singularity, is absurd. You know, ISIS-K is a derivative of the ideology of the original Islamic State, which was, founded in Syria and expanded into Iraq. In many ways, you know, we call it ISIS. That's the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Some people call it ISIS, the Islamic State in the Levant. But the idea was to create a caliphate in that region of the world. ISIS-K is a group that was born in Afghanistan out of frustration of many militants had with the policies of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, which they deemed not to be sufficiently Islamic enough. And so they looked to ISIS in Syria and Iraq and said, we want to be that way. So they modeled themselves. They said, we want to create a caliphate in Afghanistan. That's ISIS Khorasan. Boko Haram in Africa has affiliated itself with ISIS. So has other West African Islamist groups. And then we see around the world, there are people who will say, I'm motivated by ISIS, so I will act as if I were ISIS. And then ISIS, after the fact, takes credit for that. So to sit there and say that there's an ISIS playbook is wrong. There is no ISIS playbook. And so it's impossible to sit there and say that this attack, modeled itself under past ISIS practice or was a deviation from, therefore we shouldn't pay attention to it. We just should look at the attack itself. These aren't serious Islamists. They don't respect their religion. They attacked on Ramadan. They gave the Shahada incorrectly, or at least in a way that didn't show pious regard for the sanctity of the Islamic faith. They weren't acting out of a deep religious belief. Many militants, when they carry out actions on behalf of ISIS, are choosing martyrdom and are seeking to go to heaven and get their heavenly rewards for martyrdom in the name of Islam. These were mercenaries, people who were recruited for money to carry out an action for money. They planned on surviving. They had an escape plan. I think we should spend less time, saying, were they or weren't they ISIS, and more time saying, what were they? Forget ISIS. It's a cover story. It's something that's thrown out there to divert attention away from what is really happening here. And what's really happening here is that Ukraine, using a tool which made itself available, whether the tool is Islamic militants or some other tool that was disguised as Islamic militancy, Ukraine used this tool to carry out attacks on Russia. We have Budanov, the head of the Ukrainian military intelligence. We have Melnik, I think his name is. I might be pronouncing that, the head of the SBU, bragging about this attack, bragging about similar attacks. Let's stop talking about ISIS and ISIS-K, and let's focus on the problem: Ukraine and Ukraine's primary facilitator, the United States.
We know that these people were Tajiks, and do you think they were part of those people that Ukrainian embassy recruited in Tajikistan?
We'll find out with the investigation. I doubt that they are people that were recruited by the Ukrainian embassy in Tajikistan, because from what I understand, at least two of them, and maybe all four of them, were residents of Moscow, already in Moscow. But that doesn't mean we ignore the fact that the Ukrainian embassy was recruiting Tajiks, because that shows an interest on the part of Ukraine in a ethnic group that has winnowed itself into Russian society. Russia has immigration. Some of it's legitimate, some of it's illegitimate. Russia makes use of Central Asian immigrants for to provide certain labor skills, construction workers. Basically, I call the, and this is a horrible thing to say, but it's unfortunately accurate, the Central Asians are the Latinos of Russia. How the United States abuses Latino immigration to bring in undocumented aliens on purpose to allow the creation of a subclass of human beings, quasi-slavery, to do the jobs that gringos, white people don't want to do. That's somewhat mirrored in Russia with how they treat the Central Asians. I'm not saying it's a direct comparison. I'm saying it's a loose comparison, but it's there. And these populations can be exploited for by criminals, by black marketeers, by human smugglers, by drug dealers, and by foreign intelligence services. In the same way that the Kurdish population of Baghdad in the 1990s was exploited by the CIA, by British intelligence, by Israeli intelligence, by Jordanian intelligence, by Iranian intelligence, taking advantage of a ethnically separate group that existed legitimately, was there, had every right to drive taxis, own hotels, own apartments, buy food, but then, because they're separate, can create a safe haven for people who are now operating, seeking to operate out of the spotlight of government control. I know this because I personally was involved in using the Kurdish population of Baghdad in Iraq as a facilitator of intelligence collection. So I know that's how this works. I'm not being hypothetical here. So I know for a fact that the CIA, British intelligence, Ukrainian intelligence, drug smugglers, human traffickers, black marketeers are using the Central Asian population as a highway to avoid mainstream activity that is detectable by the Russian government, to stay out of the spotlight. And so I don't think we discount what the Ukrainians were doing in their embassy in Tajikistan. I think we use that as evidence that shows there is an interest on the part of the Ukrainians to develop connectivity with the Tajik community inside Russia that can be used for nefarious purposes.
They train these people in Turkey. There are some reports that they're talking about these trainings were done in Turkey to prepare these people.
Like I said, the investigation's still ongoing. That's a possibility that that they were trained in Turkey. It doesn't advance any theory in and of itself. Remember, I guess we need to introduce your audience to the concept of covert. Let me remind you what covert means. It means it's deniable. It means that as you set up the operation, you are doing it in a way that will never allow it to come back to you, will always allow it to be seen as something else, so that if it gets exposed, it's deniable. We weren't involved. We didn't have anything to do about that. So if you're going to be training people who are going to be operating inside Moscow with a high probability of compromise, capture, death, do you want to train them in Ukraine with all the fingerprints attached to it there? Or will you establish a training relationship with a third party that disguises, who's behind the training in question? So the fact that we have in Turkey trainers and training opportunities that have been used not only by ISIS, but understand Turkey trains people in Turkey who are infiltrated into Syria for the purpose of taking on Bashar al-Assad. The United States uses these training facilities to train people that they want to go into Syria to take on Bashar al-Assad, or they train people that they want to infiltrate into Iraq for nefarious purposes, or infiltrate into Iraq and then onto Iran for purposes. The British do the same. The Israelis do the same. Turkey is a hotbed of international intrigue and espionage. And so if you're the Ukrainians, that's the natural place to go to sheep dip the people that you're using to attack. Sheep dip means that you're going to make them something that doesn't look like you. And so, yeah, it makes sense that it's in Turkey. But again, it's early on in the investigation, and I think we just need to see where the leads go. What we do know is that 40 people have been arrested, and so I'm fairly certain that that this will progress. A key aspect, and I learned this when I was doing my Iraq investigations, is following the money. And you learn a lot by following the money, and nothing happens without money. And money is one of those things that is, in the end, sort of difficult to eliminate in terms of the traceability, because either you have an electronic linkage that takes you someplace, or you have large amounts of cash, which in and of itself is problematic. Where did the cash come from? And the more you dig, the more you're going to find some. That cash came from someplace. As you interrogate 40 people, one or two of them is going to say, "Yeah, well, the guy who brought it, Abdul, brought the cash." Well, now you look around for Abdul. You will find Abdul because of the connectivity, cameras, etc. And Abdul will say, "I got it from Ibrahim." And then you'll find Ibrahim, and Ibrahim will say, "Well, I got it from Ivan." "Ivan? What do you mean, Ivan? We went from Abdul to Ibrahim to Ivan. Why is Ivan giving it?" Oh, we now found the Ukrainian connection, you see, because they weren't clever enough to make it five, iterations of difficulty. Because intelligence services are human. They're lazy. They make mistakes. They make a lot of mistakes. They get arrogant. They get cocky. They believe their own hype. Just ask the CIA in 2003, abducted an Egyptian cleric from Italy, only to have their entire abduction ring, 20 CIA officers, identified because of mistakes they made in their communications. The Italians were able to track down everything by going to the cell towers, getting connectivity, finding out who called who, and they put it all together. People called in their real names because oftentimes they just get lazy, they get cocky. They said, "No one's listening to me. I'm the CIA. I'm really good at what I do. So I'm just going to call up my friend Paul because I'm on an encrypted phone and they'll never know." But they now know because the number's linked to you and you gave away your name, and boom. They just make mistakes all the time. And depending on the amount of pressure that's placed on them, the time frame that they're operating in, the more mistakes might be made than normal. We'll find out how good the Ukrainians were in this. I will say that the Ukrainians were very sloppy because the fact is, I mean, again, if part of my escape plan is to have the attackers while they're moving in a car, making phone calls across a heavily secured border to a reception committee to open up the border. At a minimum, I am going to use burner phones, meaning that whatever phone communicating with it, you should have a series of burner phones for phase one phones. At the end of phase one, all those phones get destroyed. You flop over to new phones and you initiate different protocols. Phase two, you get rid of those phones, you switch over to the third phase, new protocols. And at each phase of the operation, new phones are brought in. Why? Because it makes it difficult. But if you use the same phone throughout and then one of your phones are compromised, your entire network's blown. And that's what happened here. That's lazy. That shows you a lack of attention to detail by the planners. And if they made that kind of mistake there, I guarantee you they made mistakes in other parts of the operation, especially when it comes to money. Because as I said, money is a very difficult thing to hide. The money trail is always the one that ends up being sort of the fatal flaw in the operation. And I think the Russians right now are working really hard to follow the money, find out who funded this, where the money came from. And there's a reason why I think the Russians are as confident as they are about Ukraine being behind this, because I think they know. And now what they're trying to do is just back up the certainty of knowledge with enough hard factual information that can be released public. Remember, the Russians aren't the United States. They don't feel an inherent need to sacrifice classified operations and classified methodologies to appease public curiosity. They will release the information necessary, fact-based information, but they're not going to do it in a way that compromises how they operate, how they work. And so, right now the Russians are in the business of hunting down the money. If this was the United States, we'd have somebody somewhere calling up a reporter, leaking information, and then all the sensitive technologies and methodologies and identities would somehow make it into the newspaper because everybody wants their 15 minutes of fame. In Russia, they don't care about their 15 minutes of fame. They only care about the results. And so we'll get the facts when it's time, and I'm pretty sure the facts will be definitive enough to condemn Ukraine, but the Russians are going to operate on their timeline. They're not driven by any outside artificialities.
When it comes to the reasons behind this attack, do you think they wanted to do this before the presidential election? What's the gain for them, for the Ukrainian, if we assume that Ukrainians were behind this attack? Did they want to make some sort of security problems in Russia to show that Putin is not that strong? They are so weak when it comes to their security.
Well, we know it. We don't have to speculate here. Budanov and has talked about the fact that Ukraine was launching operations that were designed to disrupt the elections, to suppress the vote, to undermine the Russian opinion of Vladimir Putin. How do we know this? Because Ukrainian intelligence, military intelligence, was behind the efforts by Russian nationalists to attack in the Belgorod region and Kursk region. And the leaders of these nationalist groups have come straight out. We're doing this to disrupt the elections. We're doing this to disrupt the elections. So Russian nationalists, organized by Russian intelligence, is attacking Russia to disrupt the elections. Disrupt it in two ways: undermine confidence in Putin and suppress voter turnout. There's two important data points that came out of the presidential election. One is the one that in the West we focus on, 88% support for Vladimir Putin. But see, we focus on that because then we like to attack it by saying, yeah, but he had no real opposition. So of course you got 88%. But the most important number, and first of all, I love Maria Zakharova coming back saying, well, At least he had some opposition. I remember the BBC reporter, she said, "What opposition did Sunak have? None." So don't lecture Russia about democracy. And again, in the United States, what opposite? I mean, we instead of one person, we got two, Trump and Biden. Is that really a choice? No. Did the American people really? So this notion about a lack of options for the Russians is absurd. They had the best option available, the guy who saved them from the catastrophe of the 1990s, who saved them from the expansion of NATO, and who saved them from the disaster of Ukraine. If you didn't have a strong personality like Vladimir Putin, Ukraine would be part of NATO today, and NATO would be continuing its policy of breaking up Russia, destroying Russia, and bringing the Russians back to the decade of the 1990s. So was there really any other choice for the Russian people? No. And their satisfaction with that reality is reflected in the second data point, which is 77% participation. In the United States in 2020, at a time when, we had more people vote for Donald Trump, got the second largest number of votes in the history of presidential elections. If it weren't for Joe Biden getting a couple million more, he would have been the guy who got more votes. So Biden got more. So combined, we're talking about the largest level of Democratic participation in the American Democratic experience, 66%. Russia got 77%. In an election where there was only one choice, Vladimir Putin. So it tells you they were voting for something more than just a leader. They were voting for Russia. They were voting about Russia. They were saying, "We have confidence in Russia. We believe in what's happening. We believe in this system." And so the goal of the people doing these attacks is to lower that number, the participation number. You see, the lower it is, the more you can make the argument that even though Vladimir Putin won, he doesn't have the widespread support of the Russian people. If they could have gotten that number down to 48%, they could have said more than half the Russians don't believe in Russia. And that was their goal, to attack, to lower confidence, to lower, but it didn't work. Now, who's behind the Ukrainian intelligence? Is this really their strategic objective? They're fighting for their life on the battlefield. Are they really interested in this election thing? The United States is the driver for that. The CIA is the driver for that. The CIA is behind the Ukrainian intelligence organization of these Russian nationalists attacking Belgorod. And the CIA has been behind since 2004 ongoing efforts to interfere with the Russian election process to undermine confidence in Putin and bring out, suppress the vote so that Putin could be replaced. This is a CIA-driven policy. Now, whether or not that translated into the direct attack, we don't know. What I can say is there's no doubt in my mind that the Ukrainians intended to have this terrorist cell launch an attack on May 9th against Shaman to destroy Russian confidence. The Ukrainians right now have only one path to victory against Russia, and that's if, together with the collective West, they can, through economic sanctions, collapse the Russian economy, and through the prolongation of this conflict, collapse Russian confidence in Vladimir Putin as a leader. And then somehow create the conditions for what they call a Moscow Maidan. There was hoping that, the Prigozhin revolt that took place in June of last year appears to have been a Ukrainian operation directed by the CIA. We know that Prigozhin was in contact with the Ukrainian intelligence leading up to this decision, and he was led to believe that if he moved on Moscow, that people in Moscow would rise up in support of him, and that there could be a Moscow Maidan moment where the Russian population rushed into the streets of Moscow and said, "We don't trust Putin anymore. We put our faith in Prigozhin," and they sweep him out of power. That was the hope. That was the dream. That's what the Ukrainians wanted. That's what the Americans wanted. It didn't happen. They want to make the same thing happen. So by launching an attack like this, if it had been done against Shaman, could have precipitated in the minds of the sick people who think that this is a good thing, precipitated social unrest akin to what happened in Kiev in February of 2014, the Maidan moment. They want a Moscow Maidan to slip them away. That's their only hope. And so you have Ukrainian intelligence willing to do things like carry out long-range strikes against Russian oil terminals, oil depots, refineries, in an effort to suppress the Russian economy, and these ongoing attacks to take out journalists and Russian nationalist thinkers like Darya Dugina and Tatarsky to take out Ukrainian politicians in downtown Moscow with a bullet to the back of the head. They've admitted this, to blow up the Crimea Bridge. They've admitted, they said, we do it all. And then when they said, what about this attack? They said, we love it. We love it. We want more of it. I mean, it's kind of this childish, this attitude. So yes, they did it to disrupt the elections. Yes, they did it to undermine confidence in Vladimir Putin. But more important, they did it just to terrorize the Russian population as part of this overall effort to create a Moscow Maidan moment. It's backfired. It shows you how stupid these people are. Putin is stronger than ever right now, more popular than ever. The Russian people are more unified than ever. The people who are advising these people about what to do to get certain outcomes are people totally ignorant of the reality of Russia today. Why don't they do? I mean, gosh, CIA, send people to Russia. You could have sent somebody undercover to go and tour around in May of last year. You see what I saw. You'd say, wait a minute, these people are pretty united. You could have come with me in December and January and see a united people, a strong people, a resilient people. Then you could have gone back to NATO or to Langley headquarters and said, this is insanity what we're doing. It's supposed to be an intelligence organization, mean intelligent, smart, fact-driven. But they're not. They're people who have totally lost contact, connectivity with Russian reality, and they're operating under this fantasy-based system where they've allowed anti-Putin sentiment and emotions to dictate, you know, a new reality that's so divorced from what's really going on to create this fantasy world that allows them to think that by carrying out an act of terrorism in downtown Moscow, they're somehow going to bring Russia down. It's crazy.
If we finally find out that Ukrainians were 100% behind this terrorist attack, do you think that the desperation that they're feeling on the battlefield is part of this terrorist attack? Because we know that Victoria Nuland was talking about a nasty surprise for Russians. And she was talking about asymmetric warfare. This is part of that policy, in your opinion?
But that's been the policy from the very beginning. The West has always known that Ukraine will not win against Russia. Ukraine can't win against Russia. It's physically impossible. Please put on your thinking cap. How can a nation this small beat a nation this big? Isn't going to happen, was never going to happen. It was always about prolonging the conflict enough to cause enough harm to Russia to create a shift in the domestic political mindset of the Russian people when combined, you know, if combined with the collapse of the economy, could lead to the overthrow of Russian government from within. That's always been the path to victory. Ukraine was never going to win on the battlefield, ever. Everybody knew it, except maybe a handful of Ukrainians. But even the Ukrainian generals had to know the reality. They knew they were fighting for time, hoping that if Putin got away, then the West could prevail on the new Russian government to give Ukraine its territories back. That's how they would get it, through the negotiation with a defeated Russia. So this has always been the game plan. Ukraine's always been oriented. The CIA trained Ukrainian intelligence for this kind of operations before the Russian special military operation took place. So you can't say that this happened only because of the deteriorating conditions on the battlefield. This was going to happen no matter what. The Ukrainian nationalists, again, people, you know, who are psychologists and sociologists, it's an interesting study to take a look at the sources of their hatred towards the Russians, because they hate the Russians. They dehumanize them. They call them orcs. They call them subhumans. And this isn't a new phenomenon. It's a phenomenon that dates back to the beginning of a modern Ukrainian nationalism. Stepan Bandera, Petliura, others always viewed the Russians as subhumans, the Poles as subhumans. They've spoken of the pure Western Ukrainian stereotype that's so pure that they felt akin to the Aryan supremacy of Nazi Germany. These are sick people. These are truly a sick people. They're raised from childhood to hate, to believe that they are ethnically and racially superior. And they abuse people. They're cruel to people. They are pre-programmed to do things like Babi Yar, like to be members of the ISIS, the ISATS commando, or I'm sure I'm butchering that word right now, but the death squads, the German death squads. This is what they do. This is what they love to do. This is why they don't scream out when organizations like the Right Sector appear. They don't scream out when the Azov regiment appears. They don't scream out when 48 Russians are burned to death and their dead bodies are desecrated by Ukrainian politicians, members of parliament who run around and kick the dead bodies looking for more. They don't scream out when Azov occupies the city of Mariupol in 2014, raping the women, murdering the children, abusing the Russians. They did that for 8 years. And then they allow that story to be turned into an Academy Award-winning propaganda film, 20 Days in Mariupol. The Ukrainians don't scream out and say, no, that's not the truth, because they've been brainwashed. And so these are people that think it's okay to carry out these acts of terrorism. You see many Ukrainian social media accounts just going insane, gleefully insane about the deaths of these Russian civilians. There's a problem with Ukraine. It's a sickness. It's a disease.
There is an article in The Economist. It says that the next 5 to 8 months could be crucial for Ukraine. It points out various elements about the Ukrainian manpower, the ammunition that they're receiving, the likelihood of Trump winning the U.S. election, and the possibility of a Russian offensive on Ukraine. In the next 5 to 8 months, how do you see the battlefield?
Well, first of all, come on. You and I have been talking for some time now. How long have I been saying that ammunition is going to be a problem? Forever. How long have I been saying that manpower is going to be a problem? Forever. How long have I said that equipment is going to be a problem? Forever. Training is going to be a problem? Forever. So for the economists suddenly to wake up and say, oh, this might be a problem 6 months from now. No, it's happening right now as we speak. Ukraine won't survive another 5 to 8 months under the current conditions. I don't know if people saw what's happening in Kharkov right now. Air defense is down. The Russians are now able to drop glide bombs on Kharkov. Kharkov was always one of these places that had heavy air defense, and the nationalists and the Ukrainian military could operate inside the Kharkov city environs with a sense of invulnerability. Not anymore. Russia's dropping bombs on downtown Kharkov right now, taking out these targets. That's the end of Kharkov's ability to resist. Ukraine will have to surrender Kharkov in the coming weeks, I believe, because they have no chance of holding on to it. It will be surrounded. There might be some diehard nationalists in there, but at the end, that's the end of Kharkov. And that's the future of every single place Russia wants to take right now. The Ukrainians are incapable of mounting a sustained cohesive defense, because Russia will now bring to bear weapon systems that can operate with a greater degree of freedom, because there is no more air defense capability for Ukraine. And so as Ukrainians bring troops up and deploy them and dig them in, boom, 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 they're dead. Reinforcements come in, boom, they're dead before we get to the battlefield. Commanders try to meet to discuss them, boom, they're dead. Logistical people come in and say, where do we put the fuel? Boom, they're dead before they even get to talk about it. Russia controls the air. And it's not just what Russia's doing on the battlefield now with these glide bombs, but it's what they're doing in the rear area with drones. Now they're just blanketing the rear area, killing everything that moves. And then you combine that with the fact that Russia's taking the gloves off when it comes to the strategic air campaign, and they're starting to bring in the Zircon hypersonic weapons, the daggers, the Kinzhal hypersonics. But now, because all the air defense is down, even the drones, which were pretty much put up there as bait, saying, here's all 50 drones, fire your million-dollar missiles at them. There's no more million-dollar missiles to fire at them. So the drones now are coming in hitting strategic targets. It's over. Over for Ukraine. So, the economists, they've never been right at all. They've always been anti-Russian. So the fact that they are now speculating, that is sort of their concession that maybe Russia's doing something right. But even then, they can't be honest about the inevitability and the immediacy of the collapse that's taking place in Ukraine.
I've seen that you wrote a piece on Consortium News, The French Road to Nuclear War. And I talked with Ray. He said that you wrote the draft of this article. And
guilty.
Yeah. And in your opinion, where are we headed when you look at the behavior of the French president, Emmanuel Macron?
I mean, it's a very complicated question. And it gets into the psychology of France, and it gets into the psychology of this European Union experiment that France has embraced. It gets into the psychology of France as they relate to NATO, and the fact that France has always been somewhat of a somewhat intimidated by NATO because they felt insufficient to diminished in the eyes of NATO. Macron used to be someone who looked at Europe, looked at America, looked at Russia, and said, "I don't want Europe to become the battlefield between these two superpowers." And therefore, rather than allowing Europe to be subsumed by American national security and foreign policy imperatives, that it's time for Europe to stand up on its own 2 feet and define its own security parameters and come up with its own means separate from NATO to safeguard those. That's pretty sane thought. Amazing if you ever sat down with Putin, who was saying we need a new European security framework. They're saying the same thing. They're saying the same thing. Putin's saying, "Hey, Europe, let's talk with you. Get those Americans out of there because they're troublemakers. Let's just talk to you. We'll make this thing work out." Ukraine, they can move to the European Union if they want to, but they can't be part of NATO. They can't be part of any military alliance on our border. But if you want to integrate them economically, feel free if you're going to pay the price, but don't ask us to pay the price. If you want it done, you take care of this mess, this basket case called Ukraine. But if not, then we'll do it. But you guys stay out of it because we can't mix the two systems. But Russia was more than happy to talk with Macron about this. But then, the United States and NATO is the poison pill of Europe, insisted that Ukraine had a right to have membership, and Russia drew the red line, and now we're at where we're at. But Macron, like the rest of Europe, was hesitant in leading too aggressively into the Ukrainian problem out of fear of expanding this conflict. They didn't want a world war with Russia. But the United States kept pressing, pressing, pressing. And once you commit, it's like going to a casino and you get sort of caught up in the sickness of gambling. You go in there with $500 in your pocket and say, "I'm only going to gamble $500. If I lose it, I walk away." But then you lose it and you go, "Well, in my wallet is an ATM card. I can go take out $1,000. But that when that's done, I'll walk away. But maybe I'll win my $500 back." Next thing you know, you're $1,500 down. Then you're $5,500 down. Now you've taken out your credit card because you're not just taking the cash out because you don't have cash anymore. And you burn out $8,000 in your credit card. Then you call up the bank and you mortgage the house. And then you take the kids' college fund. And now you're so far into this thing that you can't walk away because your only hope is that miracle roll of the dice or the spin of the wheel. That's it. A miracle is going to save you. And so that's the place where France is right now and Europe is, that they've bought into this American nonsense and they're hoping for the American miracle, saying, "You guys are going to save us, right?" And America went, "I'm sorry, we got domestic politics here. We got a presidential election and it's insane what Congress is doing. We're backing off. We can't give you that money we promised. We're backing off." And Macron's leaning forward, going, "Wait a minute, now I'm by myself." And see, he can't admit that he's a nobody. He can't admit that France is just a middle-sized country with no true capabilities, that France doesn't have any meaningful military power projection capacity. France is nothing, economically nothing. He can't admit that because to admit that means that Europe is nothing, that this European Union experiment has failed. And it also means that NATO is nothing more than what France was always afraid it was, nothing but an extension of American national security and foreign policy, policy imperative. And so rather than admit the truth and try and save the day by pulling back and say, "What can we salvage here?" he's going to double down. He's taking everything and he's putting it on the table and he's threatening to put it in there. And what he's saying is that they know that Ukraine's on the verge of collapsing as we speak. It's collapsing. It's happening right now. They know it's over. And the only chance they have now is to get NATO involved. But NATO's not going to get involved on its own volition. So you have to trick NATO into getting involved. So the French are going to trick NATO by getting involved by putting in a tripwire force, 2,000 men, capable of being expanded to 12,000, able to be brought up to 20,000 if you bring in Baltics. And once you get 20,000 in, if you get the Poles, the Brits, and others to come in, you might get that number up to 60,000. And if you bluff the Russians into not attacking, that 60,000 can be converted instantly into a NATO force through an Article 4 meeting. And now we have NATO troops in Western Ukraine, project air power over, and you've saved the day. You suddenly have salvaged the situation. The problem with that scenario is that the Russians aren't playing ball. They've already said the first French boot that lands on the ground, we kill it. You want to put 2,000 French boots on the ground, we'll kill them. You want to put 60,000, we'll kill them. You are never going to get that force in play. And now France is sitting there saying, "Okay, if they do that, how do we handle this now?" Okay, so we put the French forces in. Now they're going to attack. Now we're going to surge aircraft in. They're going to shoot those down. So now we're going to turn to NATO and say, are you coming to save us? And there's the gamble. Is NATO going to say yes or leave France hanging? And there's the question for Joe Biden right now in a presidential election year. France is putting him on the line. Is Joe Biden going to say, no, we're walking away from NATO after all the sound bites where he says, this is a sacred mission. We will never walk away. Is he going to walk away? Or is he going to say, God, I'm running for president. I've got to, we're not walking away. Unleash the Kraken, send in the airplanes. And now Russia goes, wait a minute, those planes took off on NATO territory. And so Russia then takes out all those facilities using assets that come from deep inside Russia. So now NATO says, well, we have to retaliate against them. And they send a strike package in to take him out. They hit Ingalls Air Base where the bear bombers were. But some of those bear bombers are part of the strategic nuclear deterrence. And they now just took out part of Russia's strategic nuclear deterrence, which under Russian the nuclear doctrine means you've declared nuclear war against Russia, equivalent, and Russia's going to nuke you. And now Russia will nuke decision-making centers in Europe. It will happen. Russia's not bluffing. And then Joe Biden's going to be sitting there going, well, I'm trying to call London, but they're not picking up because it's a smoking hole. Paris, no, they're not there either. Brussels, no, nobody's there. Damn. And the Russians are going, do you want a piece of this? And now Joe Biden has to make the decision. Do I want to sacrifice America? Because there's no coming back from this. If you fire the missile against Russia because you have to prove you're a man, everybody dies. That's the danger of this. And it's a real danger because the French are desperate. They have the desperation of a gambler at the table who can't walk away from the table. And they're getting ready to go all in. But the problem is, it's not just their asses on the line. It's all of our asses. And that's why I wrote the article, because it's imperative that people understand where we are right now and how dangerous this situation is.
The other thing would be these Taurus missiles, these long-range missiles that can hit the Russian soil, some targets in Russia. Do you think that would be a path to escalation to some sort of nuclear war?
No, not at all. Russia's already made it clear they're not going to drop a nuclear bomb on Ukraine. First of all, okay, so they strike. Russia's made it clear they can make Ukraine disappear in a day using conventional weapons. They're getting ready to make that point over and over and over again now. So, Russia's winning this war. Russia's won this war. Why are they going to change the algorithm now? So Ukraine fires a Taurus missile and gets a lucky hit, kills some people, blows up a bridge, etc. So Russia's now going to overreact and throw away everything they've worked so hard to get to here. No, Russia will just continue, maybe accelerate a little bit more, bring in a little bit more pain, but they're going to keep the course, keep it confined to Ukraine. Now, if those missiles are on board aircraft that take off from Romanian air bases or Polish air bases, that's a different question altogether. That's direct NATO conflict, and then we're on the highway to hell. But Russia's accepted the fact that the Ukrainians are suicidal right now. You got to understand, I mean, it's an imperfect analogy, but have you ever done training as a lifeguard or anything like that, where you have to go in after a drowning person? And what do they tell you? The drowning person doesn't realize you're coming in to rescue them. They're going to be hitting you. They're going to be thrashing. They're going to be headbutting you. They're going to be trying to drag you down to save themselves. That's Ukraine right now. They're in the ocean. They're thrashing. They're dying. And anybody who gets near them is going to be dragged under by Ukraine. That's the fact.
Since Biden took power, if you remember in his first interview with CNN, the interviewer was talking about, do you consider Putin as a child killer? And he said, yes, I think he is. And just today, just yesterday, he said again that he called Putin a butcher. When it comes to this type of name-calling people, specifically when it comes to the leaders of these superpowers, Xi, Putin, what they're seeking in this type of behavior that they're committing. It doesn't seem that it's going to end up to anywhere good for the US foreign policy.
Well, I mean, all Biden did is disgrace himself and disgrace the United States. It's just, first of all, it's just somewhat not only ironic, but hypocritical for Joe Biden or any American president to be throwing names around. Every American president is bathed in the blood of innocent civilians from around the world. Joe Biden, first and foremost amongst them, not only from his time as president, but his time as vice president, his time as a senator. I remind everybody listening, Joe Biden was in favor of the invasion of Iraq. Joe Biden is in favor of every military intervention America's made. There hasn't been a civilian population he hasn't been willing to drop a bomb on. So, you know, if anybody's a butcher, if anybody's a killer, it's Joe Biden. But you don't see the Russians making that claim because the Russians understand that Joe Biden represents the American people. He is the leader of the American people, and that that's not how you do business. You don't call people names. You have to sit down with these people and try and deal with them from a place of mutual respect. That's the only way you're ever going to get responsible dialogue, diplomacy that resolves these issues short of war. So the Russians aren't in the business of name calling, although they're in a better position to call people names than others. But the other thing it shows is that it means that the United States has no real policy. You see, if we had a real policy, with Russia, we would be focused on that policy. We'd be focused on executing that policy. What happens, this is, I think you guys, people who are on social media see this a lot. You know, you get into a discussion, somebody says something, you respond with some facts. They counter, you should respond with facts that they can't respond to. So they go, well, you're a fat loser who lives in your mother's basement. Well, no, but what does that have to do with what we were just talking about? Nothing, but they don't have an argument anymore. So as Russia confronts America with the emptiness of its policy objectives, not only in Ukraine, but in Israel, around the world, as Russia outflanks America diplomatically everywhere, Joe Biden is left with nothing but to say, he's a butcher. Makes him feel better. Makes him feel like he won the debate. But he didn't win anything. He just debased himself, debased America, and undercut any hope America has of trying to get Russia to the negotiating table. Because why? What incentive does Russia have to enter into negotiations with the United States when their commander in chief is speaking in such baseless derision about the Russian leader?
There are some reports reported by the Daily Mirror, and it's talking about several Englishmen are fighting on the Russian side. We see this division within the nations. Do you think at the end of the day, these politicians would take any responsibility for these stupid policies that are killing a lot of people?
Well, first of all, I'll just take umbrage at the way the question's framed. The Russians know. It's not a stupid war. The Russians are defending Russians. This war is about 8 years of Ukrainian nationalist massacres against Russian population. This war is about Ukraine being used by the West as a proxy to undermine and destroy Russia. The Russians know damn well why they're fighting. That's why 1,500 of them volunteer every day to go fight. America had 64,000 recruitment shortage. The U.S. Army had to eliminate 24,000 billets in the Army because they don't have enough people coming in. They're shrinking because nobody wants to fight for America. The British, a shrinking army. French people are leaving. NATO is falling apart. Nobody wants to fight for the West. Ukraine's run out of men. People are running away. They have to go around and thump people on the head to go fight. Russia doesn't have to do that. So don't say it's a stupid war for the Russians. They are fighting for their existential survival. And if you don't respect that, then you don't understand what this war is all about. And then it's just meaningless to have a dialogue. The Russians know damn well while they're in Ukraine. They know what's happening. They know why it's happening. And they're willing to fight and die for it. Volunteers, volunteers, volunteers coming in. There's no volunteers coming in. Now, you know, to get to the thing, look, I've said this in Russia and I'll say it out of Russia. I'm an American. While I know history and I believe that Russia is on the right side of this conflict, this war isn't my war. I'm not here to fight Russia's war. I'm here to educate Americans about the reality, educate foreigners about the reality of the conflict so they can better understand it, put it in perspective. But it's up to Russians to fight this war. So I always take a little bit of umbrage when I see foreigners fighting on the soil. As an American, I only fight for my country. I'll put the American flag on my shoulder. I'll go off and I will fight and die for the American cause. Sometimes that cause is a just cause. Sometimes it's not a just cause. As a soldier, sailor, airman, or Marine, you don't get to pick. You just say, I'm here to serve, and you pray that your politicians send you on a mission that's worthy of the sacrifice they're asking you to make. So whenever I see somebody that says I'm a Briton fighting for Russia, I'm like, well, that's your business, but I'm not gonna applaud you. The Russians can applaud you. That's their thing. I mean, if I were a Russian, I'd be thank you for coming. But as an American, I'm like, well, you sort of, what do you stand for? Are you British? You're not Russian. You're coming over here. Why? What's your motivations? Are you an adventurer? Do you want to come over to kill? Do you war tourist? What's your true motivation? Do you speak Russian fluently? Are you steeped in Russian history? Is your wife from Russia? What brought you there to do that? And it, see, I never have to question a Russian's willingness to fight in their own war. I know where they're coming from. But when they say I'm a Frenchman fighting for Russia, or this, or all the idiots going to Ukraine and doing the same thing, all the Americans out there that say this is my patriotic duty. No, it's not. America's not at war with Russia. It's not your patriotic duty to go and put on a Ukrainian uniform and fight in this conflict. So whenever I see foreigners fighting for other countries, it doesn't matter. It's even outside of this conflict too. I have a problem with that because, war. First of all, war should never be fought, and the best thing to prevent a war is to have a nation state do whatever it can, short of war, to resolve the problems that are leading to war. The nation state, the interests of the people, the collective, the government acting in their collective interests. As soon as you start inserting outsiders, you sort of cloud, you sort of muddy that water. Now it becomes something else. I think, war, if it's going to take place, should be pure. And what I mean by that is a pure conflict between two competing nations or two competing coalitions, where national interests are on the line. Because the only way you're going to resolve the war is when people redefine what their national interest is. All these people that are coming in are fighting as foreigners. They're just there to fight. They're just there to pull triggers. They're just there to kill. They're just there to get a thrill. They're just there to make money. But they're not part of the national interest. And so I dismiss them. I hope they all can go home eventually. I prefer that they went home without ever experiencing any combat. Because frankly speaking, if you're a Russian at war with Ukraine and your government has sanctioned that war and you kill a Ukrainian, you're not a murderer. You're a soldier. But if you're a Brit who goes over and puts on a Russian uniform, goes in and kills a Ukrainian, you're a murderer. You're where you don't belong. You're killing people that have no, you have no real beef with. They're not fighting Great Britain, they're fighting Russia, and now you're there, you're killing them, you're a murderer. And that's how I feel about mercenaries. I feel like whether you're an American, a Brit, whatever, if you're fighting for a country that isn't yours and you're killing people, you're a murderer. You can't say that I'm doing it for a cause, because the only cause worthy of this is in defense of your nation, in accordance with international law. If you're over there fighting somebody else's war, you're a murderer.